All right, I've got sound. Looks like I've got sound. Just going to add a subtitle on here. Digging into Son of Sam. So I was just playing some material from BitChute, and I've got another piece to play which required a second show, so because it would have, the time would have run out. But this is a Mori Terry, The Ultimate Evil. So it looks like this is from a multiple part series of podcasts. So it's not quite podcast because it's 1999, I think, but we'll see. It's 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Stand by for a wild ride tonight on the Paranet Continuum. We're going to sail right into the middle of the night, if you will, with a guest, very interesting guest. And some of you people out there who are above the age of 40 will probably recall some of these events. But, you know, let's kind of recap. In towns throughout America, they came face to face with the ultimate evil. August 1969, Sharon Tate and six others are massacred northwest of Los Angeles by followers of Charles Manson. October 1974, Arliss Perry is the victim of a perverse ritual murder in a chapel on the Stanford University campus in California. February 1977, Fred Cowan murders six people before killing himself during a day-long siege at the Neptune Moving Company in New Rochelle, New York. July 1976 through August of 77, New York City is terrorized as the Son of Sam murders leave six dead and seven wounded. February 1978, John Carr is found shot under questionable circumstances in Minot, North Dakota. October 1978, John's brother, Michael Carr, dies in a suspicious car accident in New York City. December 1981, Joseph Carroza is shot twice with a .38 caliber revolver in New Rochelle, New York. July 1983, the long-dead corpse of missing movie producer Roy Radin turns up in a California desert. And November 1984, 16-year-old Teresa Fusco is abducted, raped, strangled, and dumped nude in a wooded area in Lynbrook, Long Island, and the evil one to kill again. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Gear Magazine, which has just come out with a piece titled The Ghost of 77, was written by my guest tonight, Mori Terry, who published a book called The Ultimate Evil. Now, Mori Terry is credited by law enforcement officials as being an expert on the Son of Sam case and on cult killings. He has researched and written more than 40 articles on the topic and has served as associate producer and on-camera host for five nationally syndicated television specials based on his work. And Terry won the 1982 United Press International's Enterprise Award for investigative reporting. He has also acted as a consultant in the Atlanta child murders investigation that occurred back in the 80s. And of course, The Ultimate Evil was his very first book. And it's a pleasure to welcome to the program tonight, Mori Terry. Good morning, Mori.
Good morning, Michael. Nice to be with you.
I want to thank you for being with me at this ungodly hour over there in New York.
Well, it's payback for the people in Denver who were very nice to me back in
well, great.
1987 in the Rose Bowl on January the 25th. I'm a New York Giants fan.
So well, excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the program. As I told you earlier today when I talked to you, you're to be commended for your persistence and your perseverance in this very bizarre case that, as far as I'm concerned, I'm sure as far as you're concerned, has never been truly amiably resolved.
It has not been amiably resolved. What the case needs is a grand jury, and if a grand jury can be convened, I believe that the case at that point will be resolved. I think the case is basically solved. I think there's enough evidence to bring it to a grand jury, and hopefully that will happen at some point.
Okay. Now, before we get to the part about the article that appeared in Gear Magazine this month, let's go back a little bit in time here and kind of frame this for us. I started off by mentioning some of the trail of bodies, if you will, going back to 69 to Sharon Tate. Now, I know Sharon Tate was not involved directly with Berkowitz, but Can you establish for us what took place and kind of give us a background on what happened?
In the Tate case?
No, actually in the Son of Sam case.
Oh, sure. Between July of 1976 and August of 1977, a series of homicides, attacks with nighttime attacks occurred throughout the boroughs of New York City. There were 8 different incidents, a total of 13 victims, 6 dead and 7 wounded.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the attacks occurred in lovers' lanes. All the victims were shot with .44 caliber gun. Many were in lovers' lanes. Others were young girls walking down the street by themselves, so on and so forth. The victims were all young, white, mostly female, and it evolved into the biggest case in New York history, and one of the biggest in modern American history, and became known as the Son of Sam shootings. And on August 10th of 77, a 24-year-old postal clerk by the name of David Berkowitz was arrested outside his apartment building in suburban Yonkers, just north of New York City. And Berkowitz confessed to doing all of the shootings and to doing them all by himself. And at the time when he was arrested, he claimed that a neighbor's dog, this may register with people, was really a demon and gave him the orders to kill and so on and so forth. And that's why he did it. And there was no trial. Berkowitz avoided a trial, pled guilty, was sent away. And that was supposedly the end of it, only it wasn't. I began an investigation of it almost immediately after Berkowitz was arrested. And within almost 2 years' time, I began writing articles for the Gannett newspaper chain in Westchester County, north of New York City. And then the district attorney of Queens County, in which 5 of the 8 Son of Sam incidents occurred, reopened the case. And then went public stating he believed that Berkowitz, in fact, was part of a conspiracy. And that is sort of it in a nutshell. There have been a lot of developments over the years since then. Most recently, which the Gear magazine article covers, is that in 1996, the police in Berkowitz's hometown of Yonkers reopened the case quietly, ran a quiet investigation for 2 years, determine if Berkowitz was in fact part of a conspiracy that was concocted in their jurisdiction, and they have now determined that there is evidence indeed that he was part of such a conspiracy, and have recommended that the case go to a grand jury and the probe to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it stands as of this minute.
As of this minute. Now, how did were you? You were your background as a journalist. Is that correct?
Yes.
How did you get? How did you start getting involved in this and realizing that something just wasn't ringing true?
Like many, many people in metropolitan New York back then, you couldn't avoid the case. It was all over the front pages. It dominated the headlines,
mm-hmm.
TV news, radio news, day in and day out. And it was such a huge case. And I just became interested in it. And when Berkowitz got arrested, and a couple of comments that he allegedly made to the cops leaked out, things just didn't seem to add up. Like he would have had to have been in 2 places at once. In order to be the shooter, the police had released a series of artist drawings,
mm-hmm.
of the so-called Son of Sam, and some of them were widely, widely, widely different than Berkowitz. And I started out with those kinds of troubles on my mind and started making inquiries. And within a short time, I came up with some evidence that just convinced me to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And that led into other people in the case.
This is a very interesting case, I guess, because mostly I think because of the implications and the things that were involved. Now, going back to the beginning when I started off by, going over the trail of bodies, if you will, what is the connection, or what was the connection between, when you mentioned in your book Sharon Tate and the 6 that were massacred northwest of Los Angeles by followers of Charles Manson?
As it turns out, and this is the last thing I was looking for when I got into this case, as it turns out, Berkowitz was a member of a very sophisticated cult group that had come over from England in 1967. It was a satanic cult group, an Armageddon cult. It was known as the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Process landed in America in 67, established chapters in a number of U.S. cities, and were very active in California. And there is quite strong evidence that Charlie Manson himself had joined a Process cell in California and in 1968. And here we go into 1977, 9 years later, and Berkowitz had also joined a Process operation in New York. So on different coasts at different times, the evidence is very, very strong that both Manson and Berkowitz had belonged to the same organization.
And the other interesting thing, too, that I think is brought up also in your article, the recent article in Gear Magazine, is the possible connection between the Process Church and Sirhan Sirhan, who has been convicted and is serving time for the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Yes, I've seen Ed Sanders, who back in the early 70s wrote an excellent book on the Manson murders called The Family, Vincent Bugliosi having written the other one called Helter Skelter. Sanders had unearthed some information strongly pointing toward the involvement of the Process in the Manson case. And he had also heard things about the possibility that Sirhan Sirhan had, in fact, dabbled in Process activities. I found the same thing through a series of reports that were given to me to read. They were reports from the INS, in fact. And in it, it was stated that Sirhan Sirhan, that witnesses had told the L.A. authorities that Sirhan had attended at least one Process sex ritual in the Los Angeles area. And there was another report that a Process member was actually a chef or a cook or an assistant cook in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, which is, as we all know, is where Robert Kennedy was shot, right in that kitchen in that hotel.
As I recall, and I don't know if I remember this correctly, so maybe you may know and correct me if I'm wrong. Did not Robert Kennedy have dinner at the Tate House the night that he was killed?
Actually, I believe it was at the beachfront home in Malibu of Peter Lawford, who was a Kennedy brother-in-law, and that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were among the dinner guests.
I see, okay. Which is kind of an interesting, I guess, an interesting coincidence.
I think it is a coincidence. It seems to be a coincidence.
Yeah. Maury, let's go kind of talk about the Process, where it comes from, where it came from, where it had its origins, and how they got ever so entwined in our culture to be able to do what they've done.
The Process, which still exists today under another name, there are a number of groups on the internet these days calling themselves the Process or Son of Process, but that's not the real Process. The real Process went underground, changed its name several times, and exists today under a benign name. But it began in 1963 as an offshoot of Scientology. The head of the Process, Robert de Grimston, and his wife, Mary Ann, in London, had been mid-level officials, I'd say, or counselors in Scientology, and had a falling out with L. Ron Hubbard, and went off to start their own group, which they called Compulsion Analysis at the beginning. And they recruited among some friends of theirs and some, they were looking like all cults do for the wealthy recruits. And they gathered a group about them of such people in London. And it started to grow. And eventually they changed their name to the Process Church of the Final Judgment because they were preaching Armageddon at the millennium, hence the Final Judgment, the name of the Final Judgment. And in 1967, a group of Process members came over to America, landed in America, established chapters first in New Orleans, then where they incorporated as an occult church, and that's right in their corporate papers, readily available, and branched out into Haight-Ashbury. and along the Sunset Strip, the perfect place for New York City's Greenwich Village, the perfect places where they could find the type of young, the hippie element and all the rebellious young people that they were looking to recruit. And they arrived at a perfect time. It was the era of anti-Viet war, non-war demonstrations. You had the Free Love, the Timothy Leary's Turn On, Turn In, Drop Out, rebellion against all authority, et cetera, et cetera. And Process had fertile ground to plow in the counterculture of American youth of the late 1960s.
Particularly up there at Berkeley.
Yes, they had a chapter and they were living right in Haight-Ashbury and trying to recruit around Berkeley. And they had an address on Cole Street in the Haight, and they were only a block or so from where Manson was residing at the same time, and that was certainly his first exposure to them.
I find this all very fascinating because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, these places and these locations and the people that were, you know, circulating around all of these things, they all feed into this in one way or the other.
Yeah, that's right. Process also was up in Cambridge, Massachusetts there.
Around Harvard.
Right around Harvard. Again, they knew right where to go to get the kind, to try to recruit the kinds of people that that they were looking for, where they, figuring, of course, where they would have the most success.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Orleans, they were right in the French Quarter.
In the French Quarter?
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we'll get more into the into how they got entrenched in New York and how Berkowitz got involved with them, and what led to all of these bizarre, horrific murders. And again, this is a very interesting story. My guest is Maury Terry. We're talking to him about some late developments in the Son of Sam case. The Yonkers Police Department concludes a 2-year investigation that concludes that there was indeed a conspiracy, and David Berkowitz did not act alone. He was not the lone 44 caliber killer, as some people called him. This man was jailed for the Son of Sam murders that paralyzed New York, but did he really act alone? I'm referring to David Berkowitz, of course. A new police investigation may finally bring out the whole horrific truth, and we're talking with Maury Terry, who's in New York and who has been investigating this for many years, and through his persistence and perseverance is hopefully going to bring about, as he mentioned, a grand jury investigation, which may, of course, blow the lid off of this whole thing once and for all and bring it to an amiable close. Welcome back, Maury.
Welcome back. Nice to be here again, Michael.
Thank you. Now, let's talk about, the reason I want to kind of talk about this, too, because I think it has some relevance to today and some of the activities that we see in our culture today. And as Berkowitz mentioned on the A&E piece that you interviewed him in, he was under the influence of some kind of mind control. And is that correct?
Well, to the extent that that he was like many young people, not that they turn into killers, but there were many young people out there wandering around looking to belong to something. And it's a very old cliche, you've heard it many times, but when somebody's hungry, they'll take the bread from who's ever there to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Berkowitz was drifting about, and he was vulnerable to the rap that was laid on him all about how great the occult was, and it was a special thing to be a part of, and he was vulnerable enough to accept all of this. And as he did put it to me, once you get sucked into it, before too long, the tide's carrying you out to sea, and there's no way back to the shore, no matter how hard you may try to get back there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to him. There were a few factors in his life that made him susceptible to this, and they were able to get him to go out and believe in the religiosity part of this.
Right.
I mean, some of these people were in it for their own reasons, but Berkowitz and a number of others really believed in the religious side of this thing,
mm-hmm.
and they thought they were on some sort of divine mission when they were out there doing these things.
It's incredible.
And this was all part of the Process rap. The Process people, if one knows their background, they are not the low-level people of society at all. When they came over from England, you know, we're talking about university-educated people who led the Process. You had architects, accountants, couple of people with stage backgrounds and so on and so forth. Very, very intelligent people. And the problem is that they were also very bent and perverted themselves and lusted after power. And their idea was to recruit the David Berkowitzes of this world to go out and do their dirty work. At the same time, this devil stuff was really on the surface. They used it as a tool. But they're also operating a criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
They were into providing young kids to the wealthy for sex parties and so on and so forth. And they had their connections and their hooks and their tie-ins and their ability to blackmail down the road some pretty kinky wealthy people. And they had friends in high places, in other words, and they provided a service to those friends. And so when they needed favors, they were able to get them. And as time has gone by over the years, as I've learned, become to learn a lot more about how this Son of Sam slash process operation worked, it's become very, very clear why they were able to get away with this in New York and why when David Berkowitz got arrested and said, oh, a dog barked and I did it and the lid went on the case, it's very, very obvious why that was allowed to happen, why there was no investigation to follow up on it, because Berkowitz's confession had more holes in it than you would find in a barrel of Swiss cheese,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't care.
And we're going to get to that probably before we get done with you tonight. We're going to get to that those reasons, because as you mentioned, they had their hooks into some very high-level people.
They did indeed. And this, of course, I didn't know until the last couple of years how high up it went.
You know, that's very, very interesting. And I'll tell you, if I may quote the last two paragraphs of your article, I think that's the most chilling thing I've read in a long time. It says, the process, meanwhile, under a new name and a socially acceptable cover, as you just mentioned, is still functioning in 1998. Records show that the group has acquired millions of dollars in vast real estate holdings along the way in its quest to inspire Armageddon in time for its professed witching hour, the millennium. In other words, the process, to borrow a haunting phrase from a Son of Sam letter, is, quote, still here, like a spirit roaming the night. And that's chilling. You mentioned earlier that it's under a different name, a benign name. Is it a name that we would recognize?
It's a name that some people might recognize. I wish I could reveal it, but for obvious reasons, I can't.
But you say it's benign. It's something that nobody would ever suspect. Hello? What happened there? I don't know. Okay. We still on the air? Yes, we are. Okay, we're going to get him back. We're going to find out what happened to the connection. That was very, very odd, to say the least. While he's doing it, while Brian is getting him back on. By the way, our number is 303-860-1280, 303-860-1280. And one of the things here we got here that he's got in the article is mentions, you know, numerous names of people that have died as a result of this whole thing. And, you know, it's very, 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 very odd. Let's see if we're going to get him back in here. And I think we do have him. Again, our number is 303-860-1280, 303-860-1280. And we do indeed have him back. Let's try it back again. Maury, are you there?
Yes, Michael.
What happened? Do we know?
I have no idea. From where I was sitting, the line just went dead.
Yeah, just clicked off.
Just clicked off.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, let's go to, let's discuss the part about, I guess, where you entered into it with the first chapter of your book, The Ultimate Evil, was Satan at Stanford. There was a murder at Stanford of a young woman that was seemingly unconnected to all the goings-on in New York.
Yeah, her name was Arliss Perry. She was a native of Bismarck, North Dakota, young Christian bride, been a cheerleader and a member of various Christian organizations in Bismarck, married her hometown sweetheart named Bruce Perry.
Mm-hmm.
I have a story about Bruce, too.
Mm-hmm.
They then relocated to Palo Alto, where Bruce was studying at Stanford University to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only on the campus about 6 weeks when Arliss was found murdered in the Stanford Memorial Church. He was killed after midnight. Actually, it was this is almost the anniversary. It was the night of October 12th, 13th, 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 5 years thereafter, the case was unsolved. I mean, technically, it's still unsolved. And the Santa Clara Sheriff's Office thought they were searching for a local sexual psychopath. And then David Berkowitz, in 1979 from prison, dropped a note in which he mentioned some specifics about the Arliss Perry case, including polygraph keys, information that only the police would know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got a hold of this letter, I had never heard of Arliss Perry, never heard of the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we soon found out what it was all about. And it turned out that the information Berkowitz had was absolutely correct and on the money. And I now know how Berkowitz came to know about that. He was at a cult meeting in New York in 1977 at a house in the Bronx, I believe, on City Island.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who had been involved in Arliss Perry's killing was imported to New York to take part in the Son of Sam killings and stood up at this cult meeting in this house and started bragging about the killing and had Arliss's picture and described what had happened to her. And Berkowitz, who has a remarkable memory, remembered that. And that's how he got the information that he later put into that letter.
Now, did anybody determine, I don't recall from reading the book, did anybody determine why Arliss Perry was selected?
Arliss Perry, Berkowitz didn't know the motive,
mm-hmm.
but he knew there was a motive that they went after her for a reason.
It wasn't just a random
thing. No, it was not. Arliss Perry had done something in her hometown of Bismarck to anger some people who were involved in a chapter of the cult group in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And when she left to go to Stanford University or to accompany her groom to Stanford University, they just didn't drop it. They tailed her to California, located where she was living in an apartment on the campus,
mm-hmm.
and stalked her for a couple of weeks and set out to get her.
Now, you mentioned earlier, her husband had nothing to do with this, correct?
No. I mean, obviously, her husband was the first suspect. The way this happened was they had an argument the night of the murder in the apartment, and she went out to take a walk and went to the church where she often went since she was a religious person. But, of course, Bruce was the first suspect,
mm-hmm.
when they finally found the body. But very ironic about Bruce Perry. Bruce Perry went on to become a psychiatrist.
Really?
And in the Waco case a few years ago,
yeah,
Bruce Perry is now connected to Baylor University. And Bruce Perry was one of the doctors who was counseling the young kids who had been released from the Waco compound by Koresh before the federal government assaulted and killed all those people.
Wow.
And Bruce Perry is, I don't know whether he's in a state of denial or what, but from what I understand, he appears at conferences just downplaying occult crime in general in the United States. And, and I just want to, when this information gets back to me, it surprises me, and I just write it off to, you know, still a strong sense of denial,
mm-hmm.
about what really happened to his bride.
Wow. Hold that thought, Maury. We'll go to take another break. When we come back, we'll delve more into this this interesting case. Maury Terry is my guest. We're talking about The Ultimate Evil, the book that he wrote back in the early 80s, I believe it was. And, of course, his recent article in Gear Magazine concerning late developments in the Son of Sam case. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. My guest is Maury Terry. We're talking about David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, and we are finding out, as Maury Terry has maintained for many years, that David Berkowitz did not act alone. We're going to find out tonight why David Berkowitz why Maury Terry says that David Berkowitz did not act alone. It's because there's some very interesting developments over the years, as you heard Maury mention. And Maury, we've got about probably about 3-4 minutes before the network news. Let's talk about how your investigation went beyond Arliss Perry, what took you to North Dakota? Because that's a bizarre story as well.
Well, the North Dakota connection at first was because of one of the people who Berkowitz has now named as a co-conspirator and actually as one of the shooters in the case.
Mm-hmm.
His name was John Carr. He was the son of Berkowitz's neighbor, Sam Carr, hence the term Son of Sam. Literally, John Carr and his brother Michael were the sons of Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And John Carr surfaced as one of an immediate suspect of mine in the case right after Berkowitz was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Because of an alias used in a Son of Sam letter that happened to be John Carr's nickname. And if, as the police maintained at the time, Berkowitz didn't know the Carrs at all, well, how would he know the nickname of a guy who spent all his time in North Dakota?
Mm-hmm.
But correct. He did. And so I went looking for John Carr. And 6 months after Berkowitz was arrested, I found John Carr because he was shot dead in Minot, North Dakota, in his girlfriend's apartment on Minot Air Force Base. They first called it a probable homicide, then changed it to an apparent suicide, and then it went back to a most likely homicide. And I can tell you it's been proven that it was a homicide.
So
somebody went out to shut John Carr up within months of Berkowitz's arrest, and Berkowitz has since told me that John Carr was the weakest link because he had a bad drug and alcohol problem. And if anybody was the likely one to crack, it would have been John Carr. Of course, Berkowitz was in jail at the time,
mm-hmm.
but he said that's why they would have gone after John, because he was the weakest.
Now, where did Berkowitz get the idea to use the dog? Was that
that was concocted by him and a few of his accomplices near the very, very end of the case, shortly before he got arrested. And that was just to lay the foundation for an insanity defense, which Berkowitz later, before he pled guilty in court,
mm-hmm.
you know, abandoned that and, you know, and admitted it was nonsense. But that's the thing, you know, first impressions count. And that's the thing that thing with the dog has stuck in the minds of many people for many years. I mean, it's the most ludicrous story.
Absolutely.
That you could imagine. And why the authorities accepted it is beyond belief, and it just leads into other areas. But, you know, interesting thing about the dog, if there's a minute, the name of the dog was Harvey was the dog's name,
mm-hmm.
the talking dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, interestingly enough, and this shows you how devious some of these people are, they got, you know, in that movie, James Stewart, Talk to the Rabbit. Talking Rabbit, the invisible rabbit
right.
that only James Stewart could see. The rabbit's name was Harvey.
Oh, no.
That's where the idea came from.
So they just grabbed this stuff out of the air. Now,
absolutely. That's exactly what they did.
Wow. And
the biggest, you know, and the so-called New York's finest and all was suckered into this like they were, you know, the Hardy Boys at the age of 2 or 3 and had no knowledge about anything. It's just pathetic.
That's wild. And welcome back. 62 degrees in Denver, 106 in the morning. And, of course, in New York, where my guest, Maury Terry, is, it's much later. And I want to thank you, Maury, for being with us.
That's okay. My pleasure, Michael.
In this ungodly hour.
Or some.
Yeah. Okay, let's kind of pick up where we left off. We're talking, again, with Maury Terry, who wrote a book. When was the book published, Maury?
Hardcover, summer of 87, updated for paperback in the fall of 89.
89. And the book was called The Ultimate Evil, and it is, in my opinion, it's the concise history of a very bizarre string of murders in the New York area that stretch out, as you've been hearing, all the way to the West Coast. And we're talking with Maury Terry about recent developments in the case and an article that he has published in Gear Magazine, which is available in all, I picked mine up here in Denver, and it's available in all major stores and magazine shops. And Maury, let's go back to the New York. Let's go get back to New York after.
I'm already here, Mike.
Okay,
you come back to New York.
Okay, let's go to talk about you know, how this case unfolds, and Berkowitz is ultimately arrested now. Originally, people thought that he had basically, you know, took commands from a dog that was demon-possessed, and you have discovered, or a lot of people have discovered, the police even knew this at the time, that the whole arrest was arranged, wasn't it?
The police didn't know at the time that the arrest was really a setup. But yes, we've come to know that it was a setup. Another example of some of the vileness in the manner of thinking that goes on with some of the people involved in this. I mean, Berkowitz's apartment, which was set up to look like the lair of a madman, was indeed set up. Several days before his arrest, his apartment was a very normal apartment in a nice building overlooking the Hudson River, about 17 miles north of Midtown Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And in the dead of night, Berkowitz, assisted by three other people, cleared out, rented a U-Haul van, cleared out his furniture, and deposited it in front of a Salvation Army warehouse in a community about 6 miles away, left it right in front of the building. And then on the very day of his arrest, two other people, one of whom is named in this article for the first time, his name was John DeFrenza, and along with another guy named Richie, came over and took out some last-minute stuff, Berkowitz's mail and so on and so forth, some last-minute items. And that was literally hours before the police arrived to arrest Berkowitz. Berkowitz knew the cops were on the horizon. He knew they were coming imminently. And he knew it because the night before the arrest, the cops in New York City were checking a parking ticket that had been put on his car at the last Son of Sam crime scene out in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a routine call to the Yonkers Police Department. They thought Berkowitz might have been a witness to it. They had no idea that Berkowitz was involved in anything because they were looking for a yellow VW as the killer's getaway car, and Berkowitz was driving a full-size Ford Galaxy, which had been ticketed a couple of blocks from the crime scene for parking too close to a hydrant.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just doing a routine check of potential witnesses. And they actually, the New York City cops, actually tried to call Berkowitz at home, which I find amusing. If he was home and answered, what would he have told them, you know? They did. And they got lazy. He didn't answer the phone, so they decided to let the Yonkers cops do their work for him.
Mm-hmm.
So they called Yonkers and to say, we have somebody call Berkowitz or knock on his door and ask him to give us a call. Well, lo and behold, who answers the phone at Yonkers Police Department but the daughter of Sam Carr, the sister of John Carr and Michael Carr. She has the unusual name of Wheat Carr. She was a civilian dispatcher for the Yonkers PD.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes New York calling up saying, yeah, would you send somebody up to ask Berkowitz to give us a call? And she goes right into her act. Berkowitz, oh, him, you know, we think he shot our dog. He's this, he's that. We think he's the son of Sam. So suddenly potential witness Berkowitz went to the top of the list as a possible suspect. And the very next day, New York went up and arrested him. But since the call came to, coincidentally, Wheat Carr, of course, she immediately told her brothers. Berkowitz was tipped off, and Richie and John DeFrenza go over and take out some last-minute stuff the next morning, and there's Berkowitz when the cops come out and arrest him outside his building that night. And, many people wondered why Berkowitz had this enigmatic grin on his face when he was escorted into police headquarters in front of all of the cameras.
Right.
Now I know why he did. Now I know why he did.
Was she involved? Was she involved in this whole deal? Maybe.
I'd say that it's fair to say that she is under intense scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We'll take that up after the break, and We'll kind of come up to the present day and the thing that has led to Maury's article in Gear Magazine. Our number, my guest is Maury Terry, and we're talking about the infamous Son of Sam case and something that occurred back in the late 70s, middle 70s, late 70s in New York. And it's an incredible story. And, of course, Maury Terry has been on it and developing quite a bit of material over the years. And, Maury, let's talk about the stuff that's developed since Berkowitz was convicted and has been in prison. You've developed quite a bit of wild information that kind of leads, like you mentioned earlier, to very high places.
Yeah. I mean, when I did The Ultimate Evil, information alluding to the upper levels of society,
mm-hmm.
There was information in the book about that in the late 80s, but it wasn't specific information because I didn't have specific information. I was dealing through a handful of prison informants who had gotten close to Berkowitz, and he told them certain things. But since I've been able to sit down with Berkowitz, which started in 1993,
mm-hmm.
A lot of other very specific information has been developed as to who these people were. Other informants have come forward. There's a guy who was involved with the process, who's in prison in the South today. He's mentioned in that article. His name is Jesse Turner. Jesse Turner provided very, very specific information about the process and their hooks into the upper levels of society, both in New York and what they were doing in New Orleans, which is where Turner spent almost 2 years with them, and he later hooked up with them again in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So between the various sources of information over the last few years, very specific evidence has been developed pointing to exactly how this whole setup worked and how they were able to get away with it and what types of people were involved on the upper levels. And there were two aides to New York City's mayor at the time, Abraham Beame.
Mm-hmm.
There was a then Yonkers judge. There were a couple of Westchester County, which is where Yonkers is, the county just north of New York City, politicians. And there were a couple of New York State level politicians involved with this group. And by that, I want to emphasize, I don't mean that they were sitting down planning the murders with them, but they were in the social circles with this group. They were at sex parties together.
Mm.
The people I'm alluding to had a thing for young kids, and young kids were provided at these parties.
God.
And when Berkowitz got arrested, you can see why people like this would be scurrying around and using their old boy network behind the scenes to make sure the case wasn't pursued further,
mm-hmm.
because it would lead right into their twisted lives. I was shocked at how high up it went. I'm not shocked that top-level officials are, some of them, are into young kids. That doesn't shock me.
Mm-hmm.
But it just shocked me that it was so in this case, and how wide the net was spread in order to keep the lid, I'm mixing metaphors, on the case.
Right, right. The thing that appalls me, and I don't know if you know Senator John DeCamp, but
I'm certainly familiar with the case. I read a book that came out about that.
It was called The Franklin Cover.
Yes, out of Nebraska, right?
That's right. I interviewed the gentleman a couple of months ago on my program, and it was sickening. I mean, to me, you say you're not surprised, but of course, after the investigation that you've been involved in, I understand. But, it just blew me away to hear of the kind of stuff that was going on. But, you know, the thing I wonder is, how does this kind of thing happen, and how do people at these levels get involved in something as heinous and horrific as this?
There's the Paul Revere and the Raiders song from 1966, which I always thought says so much, and the name of the song was Kicks, and it was Kicks Just Keep Getting Harder to Find.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of these people, when they have the money, when they have the power, they've done everything, and they keep looking for the next thrill. What'll turn me on next? And some of them, it eventually leads into sex with kids and snuff films and so on and so forth.
Good heavens.
Because they have done everything else. I mean, there was a snuff film, and I put Berkowitz on TV confirming this, Made of the Last Son of Sam shooting.
Right, I remember seeing that on the art.
They made a damn movie of it.
And they were selling it.
It's a real collector's item. It's one of those things, like you hear about valuable pieces of artwork being
mm-hmm.
stolen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't exactly advertise in magazines saying, buy this. But there are collectors who will pay a fortune just to have a stolen piece of valuable stolen piece of art, you know?
Yeah.
And it was this way, as I understand it, with the Son of Sam snuff film, that there were a handful of copies made. And that they went for an awful lot of money.
One of the names that came up in the A&E piece that you're referring to was Robert Mapplethorpe.
Yeah, Robert Mapplethorpe. Again, a friend of this individual named Jesse Turner, who's presently in jail for bank robbery, who I mentioned a few minutes ago. Turner and Mapplethorpe had known each other very well. Turner actually lived with Mapplethorpe when Mapplethorpe, in the early 70s, was dating and living with Patti Smith, the well-known rock singer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Turner was living with them in another bedroom in the apartment. Mapplethorpe was mostly gay,
mm-hmm.
but whatever he did with Patti Smith, I don't know. But that's why, and Mapplethorpe was involved with the process. And Mapplethorpe, as if people are familiar with him, may know, was one of the real kings of kink. I mean, his photography and his artwork and all was homoerotic to the nth degree,
mm-hmm.
and scandalous to the minds of many, many people. And there was a big furor, I believe, in the late 80s when the National Endowment for the Arts funded a display of his work, or an exhibit of his work in Cincinnati, and there was all sorts of repercussions
because right.
it was called just outrageous stuff. But Turner had been involved with process, and so was Mapplethorpe. And when they wanted this Son of Sam movie back, the word was passed through Mapplethorpe. Can you find somebody who will go get this film back from the guy who's got a copy of it? And Turner said to Mapplethorpe, sure. And he recruited two guys who went into this brownstone in Manhattan on Halloween of 81 and got the film and killed the guy. Ronald Sisman, his name was, along with a young college co-ed who was in Sisman's brownstone at the time,
mm-hmm.
and took off with the film. And according to Turner, that film and four others were then sent to Mapplethorpe's post office box in Lower New York City by the gunman who did it. Now, just two years ago, the New York City cops hauled in these two alleged gunmen,
mm-hmm.
who were named by Turner. One of them blew the needle off the poly machine. He was lying so badly. And the other was caught four times trying to beat the machine. The two of them then hired lawyers. And that case right now is at a stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
There were detectives in the NYPD who wanted to keep going with this, but when the top of the department learned that this was leading right into the Son of Sam case, they put the lid on it.
Wow. Now, and of course, this is was this referred to in the video piece? That was this referring to the part where the NYPD had opened the investigation? And
that's exactly what it was. And Ronald Sisman, who was murdered there in his brownstone in 81 along with the co-ed,
mm-hmm.
Sisman was actually the guy in the van at the last Son of Sam scene who was running the camera.
Mm.
They had a van parked across the street. There were three people in it. I know the identities of all three. Sisman was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Sisman, they whacked to get the film back, in his copy of the film back in 81. One of the other people in the van was a very close associate of somebody you mentioned earlier in this program, was named Roy Radin, who was
right.
Another kinky guy with a ton of money from Southampton, Long Island, who was trying to enter the movie business as a producer and was murdered over the film The Cotton Club in Los Angeles outside of L.A. in 1983. And the third person in the van was, well, okay, I'll leave the third person out of it.
Okay.Ay. The thing is that when your investigation has taken you, as you mentioned, Roy Radin, for example.
I'll tell you something about Roy Radin. The person who, one of the people involved in Radin's murder was also a shooter in the Son of Sam case.
Now, is that the guy that's now in prison that was dubbed Manson too?
That's correct.
I don't recall his name now.
Well, I haven't released the whole thing publicly, but I will before too long, I think.
Okay. I know Sanders mentioned some of this stuff in his book. When he was talking about the family of Manson and all that. Let me ask you this. I know that Manson was involved in producing films of that nature. And I'm just wondering, you know, the one question that comes up into my mind that I've wanted to ask a person like yourself who's really been deeply involved in the investigation of this stuff. Sanders alluded to the idea that there might have been some kind of intelligence community involvement in some of this activity. Have you run across anything like that in
here? Sanders mentioned that to me, too. Let me respond to it this way. I think it was a fair thing for Ed Sanders to wonder about.
Mm-hmm.
I have wondered about it, too. I'm not saying it's so.
Right.
The reason I have wondered about it is because I cannot understand how an organization like The Process was allowed to enter this country and still exists in this country. I mean, Vince Bugliosi pointed the finger at them in Helter Skelter. Mm-hmm. Sanders did it in The Family. I did it in The Ultimate Evil and on television and elsewhere. And that the fact that these people have not been arrested and or deported is beyond belief. It almost makes me, I mean, I know the FBI is very capable of falling asleep at the wheel. I've seen it enough. And INS sometimes is a joke.
Uh-huh.
It's a big bureaucracy. But it's not as if people haven't been pointing fingers at Process. They have. Why are they still in existence? Why are they operating in America stronger today than ever?
That's
I mean, they have amassed a fortune in a lot of it is now in real estate and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I could say this, the original core, with one or two exceptions, of Process leaders who came to America in 1967 are still together today.
Wow.
All together, and they're a lot closer to where you're sitting than where I'm sitting.
Oh, God. that's not good to hear.
No, it's an absolute fact. It's an absolute fact.
Oh, boy. Well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll pursue even more of this. And very, very interesting. Murray, I want to thank you again, you know, for being on the program. This is very fascinating stuff.
It's good talking to you.
We're going into the night with Maury Terry, and we're talking about David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, a very, very bizarre murder case. And, of course, as you've been hearing, David Berkowitz did not act alone. There was a conspiracy. And then, as we're being told by Maury Terry, it involves very high-level people. And
yeah, that I'd like to say, Michael. You know, just before the break, we were theorizing or speculating a bit on the possibility of some intelligence community connection somewhere into this process
right.
organization. That's speculation. What isn't speculation is that there, in fact, was a big conspiracy in the Son of Sam case that reached into high places.
Mm-hmm.
That's been corroborated. There are witnesses. There are supporting data. That's beyond theory.
That's fact.
Is absolute fact. Berkowitz has made statements, and they have been corroborated left and right, from crime scene evidence through events in his life, through people in his life, through the activities of other. When we talked before about how his apartment was, they took the furniture out of his apartment. All that's been corroborated. Everything. I wouldn't come on your air blowing smoke about things unless I knew them to be so. And if it is a theory, I'll label it as a theory.
Yeah. What was the victims that felt that were to this thing? Were they random? How many of them were random, or were they not random?
Well, that's another thing, and I'm glad you put that point up because to my mind, and this has not gotten enough publicity, this is one of the critical factors of the case. I mean, at the time, it was believed that all the Son of Sam killings were done by a random psychopath. Well, psychos don't have legitimate motives for doing what they're doing.
Right.
Supposedly crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is extremely strong evidence, and Berkowitz has confirmed that it's so, that at least two of the Son of Sam victims, two out of the eight attacks, were not random at all, but were hits, what were target hits,
mm-hmm.
that they were. They went deliberately after the victims. By itself, that blows out the entire perception of what the public believed the Son of Sam case to be.
Right. Did these people, the two out of the eight, as I understand it, and I think I read this in your book, as I understand it, that the random ones, where they were done that way to basically throw people off of the trail of a deliberate hit or assassination.
Right. In a way, the first Son of Sam shooting was a hit against a girl in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, they were on this campaign of terror anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing served a couple of purposes, and they were able to sneak a couple of hits into a string of otherwise random attacks, random as to the rest of the victims, but not random as to location. All these locations were carefully scouted for the best chance of doing something and getting away with it and so on and so forth. But two of the victims were hits. The first one was a hit because she lived in an area in the Bronx and where she came in contact with some members of this cult. She also went to a nightclub in nearby that was frequented by cult members. The point being that she heard about what they were up to and the kinds of things they were planning, and she had a big mouth, and she was killed for that reason.
Gosh.
One of the others, midway in the string, was basically a contract hit. They took a contract to eliminate somebody over some convoluted lover's triangle.
Good heavens. The hell of a thing to kill.
And then the last one they made a movie out of, at the behest of Roy Raiden.
Jeez. Now, in your article in Gear Magazine, you mentioned that the new investigation was opened in the spring of 96, which was spurred by the death of a prominent New York businessman and a handful of portraits that were sketched 20 years earlier. And of course, this was also featured in the A&E piece. Tell us a little bit about that. I know that you're not going to release the name of the businessman, but what was surrounding that? There's chilling parts of this article.
We had information about one of the top leaders of this group who resided in Westchester County,
mm-hmm.
including his profession, which was real estate.
Yeah.
And generally where he lived and so on and so on. Well, by 1995, I had the name
mm-hmm.
of who he was. And then I just happened to catch a death notice in the paper in 1996
mm-hmm.
that this person had died. The police were alerted immediately, and they had had a sketch that had been provided to them by this young guy who was a budding artist back in 1976, 20 years before.
Right.
And he hung out for several weeks that summer, just before the Son of Sam murders began, in a wooded park, big wooded park, former estate in Yonkers, just near Berkowitz, where Berkowitz was living, with some of this cult group. He didn't know who they were, what they were up to, or that they were about to start on a murder campaign, and they tried to recruit him.
Is this that Untermyer Park?
That's right. And this young budding artist would hang out with them for a while, and then he'd go home and sketch. And he sketched four or five of the people up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he sketched somebody. One of them happened, as it turned out, happened to be the leader of this group. And this kid didn't know that then. But the sketches were, in the 90s, turned over to the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I noticed the obit, this guy had died, you know, the cops went up and went in to the wake. And off the sketch, ID'd the guy. And they called me and told me, it's him. And I said, well, you guys weren't the ones who saw him in Untermyer Park. Let me find the artist. So I found the artist, and they went and picked him up and took him up to the wake and walked him in. And he said, what am I supposed to do? They just said, just go and see if you recognize the guy lying in the box. And he comes back out of the funeral home and said, it's him. How the hell did you know it was him? How did you know? And, of course, they wouldn't tell him. But a remarkable story.
But he went by the name of Moloch?
That was his so-called occult name. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And
in real life, he was in his 70s at the time of his death.
Yeah.
And he was a wealthy real estate guy who had done consulting work for the state of New York and et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. God.
The reason I can't name him is because he has a couple of relatives who are also strong suspects. Otherwise, I would tell you his name right now.
Yeah. What was about the Untermyer Park, though? I mean, there was in the A&E piece, they showed the there's like a gazebo or something like that.
Yeah, Untermyer, the Untermyer estate goes back many years. It was originally owned by Samuel Tilden, who ran for U.S. president in 1876 against Rutherford B. Hayes.
Uh-huh.
And in 1903, it came into the hands of a wealthy lawyer named Samuel Untermyer. And Untermyer was very much into the occult himself. Today in the park, the remnants of his statuary and all are still there, and it very clearly shows his fascination with the occult.
Mm-hmm.
He imported statuary and everything from England, you know. And when Untermyer died in 1940, the place went into disrepair and so on and so forth. And, of course, the legend about it grew that it was sacred ground to those in the occult because they knew about Samuel Untermyer and his affinity for it and so on and so forth.
So there was a lot of activity there.
Yes, and it was, you know, central casting couldn't have put up a better place for cult rituals to occur.
Gives me the creeps I've never seen.
Yeah, it's, you know, like 25 or 30 acres or something,
uh-huh.
heavily wooded with all these old monuments and statues and everything like that. Again, just picture something Hollywood would do and you'd say, this couldn't exist in real life, but guess what?
God. What kind of a man is Berkowitz?
he's totally unlike the public perception of him at the time, although he's the first one to admit that he was out of it then. He to this minute, he can't understand how he got so crazy involved in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He has tremendous amount of remorse. And he really doesn't think he deserves to get out of jail. You know, a lot of these guys are saying, get me out of here, get me out of here. Berkowitz thinks he belongs there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, I did kill a couple of these people. I did do some of the shootings, not all of them, and I was involved in all of it as a conspirator. He's very open about it, so he's not trying to get out of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, he's very intelligent. He has an excellent sense of humor. And if you had ever met David Berkowitz in a bar or something and started talking sports with him, you wouldn't have any idea.
Really?
Who he was or what he had been involved with. That's the kind of person he is.
Now, in your book, you mentioned when he first went into prison, he was very reticent about talking. And there was something mentioned about his father. Why is he talking now?
Because his father, one of the reasons, there are two main reasons. One is that his father is now, 88? And he's lived a good long life and he's been safe.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, probably a bigger reason than that, is that in the late 80s, Berkowitz became a born-again Christian. And he feels an obligation, mm-hmm, because of his religion, to say as much as he feels safe in saying about this.
Yeah.
I mean, getting him to a courtroom is another matter. I don't know if that would ever happen. But he has felt obligated to make some statements about it, and things that he said that I put on television were extremely important and very helpful and very concise.
Is he, the threat still as potent as it was before, or is he just, because of his conviction, his conversion to being Christian, it outweighs his fear of what could happen to him if he talks?
I think there's still a battle. I know there's still a battle going on inside of him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, part of him wants to be extremely helpful, but there's the other part. You know, he's been in prison a long time, and there's the jailhouse code. You're not supposed to be a snitch.
Right.
So he's torn between the two things, and I think he has come up with a compromise in his own mind, whereas he had agreed to say enough to corroborate things and to let the investigation move forward. But he, you know, there's a certain line that he doesn't want to cross.
Right, right. How has this affected you? I mean, you put a lot of years into this.
I've done a lot of other things too, thankfully. I mean, from 88 to 93, had nothing to do with the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It had ceased. I was doing other things, other cases, moving on and doing a lot of television and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in 93, I did a big thing with Berkowitz when he first spoke on television.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got involved in the Simpson case, the OJ case, and then came back to Son of Sam after the Simpson case. So, in other words, I haven't had to live it 24 hours a day for all these years. I've certainly had extended periods of time when I've been away from it and doing other things. I found, mm-hmm, that you can't let something like this take you over, or you can just be, you know, get swallowed up by it.
Has this changed you in any way?
I think it's made me much more cynical, because I now have
yeah,
virtually no trust in the powers that be. I see the lies that are told every day,
mm-hmm,
and I see how cover-ups work, and I don't have a lot of respect for law enforcement in general. Lord knows there are a lot of great cops out there and a lot of great detectives, but there's a lot of real incompetence in law enforcement also. And once you get to the higher levels of it, where it becomes political,
yeah,
where police officials and all are playing games with City Hall and so on and so forth, and where it's the CYA, cover your whatever attitude takes over, I think there's a great disservice being done to the public in many, many jurisdictions throughout this country.
I'm curious, you know, when you talk about this kind of stuff, do you feel that a lot of this stuff is leading us somewhere, and that, you know, the process, for example, was just one of those stepping stones to something much bigger or something much more sinister, or do you think that, you know, this is just the way it plays out?
I don't know how much more sinister than one can get than the process is all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't know, and I don't know if I'll ever know, and frankly, I don't know if I want to know, is if some of these things we've talked about, what could be above them. Whether there's something above them or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
One would suspect there is, only because, as I said before, how in God's name are they allowed to exist for so long?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's a very good question.
You know, is law enforcement that incompetent, or do they have friends in high places? Well, I know they have friends in high places,
mm-hmm.
but do they have friends in places high enough to make sure that nobody bothers them? You know, are they is what Sanders speculated true? Could they perhaps be in a rogue intelligence operation gone awry at some point? And rather than expose that and all of the repercussions that would come from that people in high places look the other way. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had to work from the bottom up on this, and I think we've gotten pretty high with it, you know?
Yeah.
And I wish the FBI would get off its, you know,
posterior,
right? and go out and mount a real investigation into this, you know?
Yeah.
Although they're probably too busy trying to figure out who killed JonBenet Ramsey.
Do we see any evidence in our culture today? Do we see any evidence of this activity, like in murders that occur, you know, things that we hear in the news? Is there anything that you see there that is connected to this?
That I can't really say at this point, because, you know, there are people keeping an eye on what the process is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, the 60s are over with, the 70s are over with. They don't go around with the black capes anymore.
Yeah.
They've abandoned the satanic
They're in suit
stuff
and tie.
Entirely. They're on the internet. They're doing things very sophisticated.
Yeah. Okay, Maury, we're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a moment with that. Maury Terry is my guest, and we're talking about the Son of Sam case. Maury, where is all this going to go? I mean, are you hopeful that in a short time, I mean, are we just kind of like, you know, kind of pointing to the wind with all of this? Do you think anything is ever going to come down and get resolved on this?
I would... In a sense, it has been resolved, Michael. I mean, we now know what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I can't convene a grand jury.
Right.
I don't have a badge, a gun, or a subpoena power.
Uh-huh. You know, you ought to, really,
yeah,
because you've done a hell of a job with this.
Sometimes I wish I could. But, you know, I feel that it's to a point where I've basically taken it almost as far as I can take it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been served up now on a silver platter, and the recent investigation by Yonkers, which lasted 2 years. Yonkers is a big city. It's the fourth largest city in New York State. We're not talking about some podunk police department here. We're talking about a police department that has over 500 people on it. So it was a big city investigation.
Mm-hmm.
They've come up with the same thing I've been saying for years, and what the Queens DA in New York back in the late 70s and early 80s came up with also. There was, in fact, a conspiracy in this case. So I think it should be federal. I think this was interstate. It absolutely was interstate conspiracy to commit murder. And there's an ongoing criminal enterprise here. And I believe it calls for federal intervention, because only the feds have the jurisdiction, really, the budgets, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
who can cast the net across the various states where this whole thing has been operating and continues to operate today. As I said earlier, with a couple of exceptions, the original core of process, and that's over a dozen, the leaders of this whole thing are still together in the same place.
How much do you think Berkowitz has withheld up to this point?
Not a lot.
So
really.
He's actually pretty much told it all.
Well, as far as he can go, considering the environment he's in, I mean, he has certainly provided enough leads where things were able to go out and be investigated and be corroborated.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be enough?
And there have been other informants, other sources, other participants or fringe people like Jesse Turner, who we talked about before,
right,
who have been able to provide names and so on and so forth. It's absolutely safe to say now that the identity of all the Son of Sam shooters is known. The identities of those who assisted at crime scenes is known. The identities of the people who ordered this thing, who set it up, are known.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a pretty good handle on the reaches into the upper levels that this thing had and how that was accomplished through process's ability to reach out for people and provide them with kids and all and get them into the web and make them vulnerable because of their sexual perversions.
Jeez, do you foresee a book, another book, for you?
I don't know. I don't know if they. I know The Ultimate Evil. I have reason to believe through conversations with publishers that The Ultimate Evil is probably going to be released again next summer. Whether or not there will be another book is hard to say. That depends on the publishing world. I mean, it might be at the stage now where publishers would say, well, you know, only if there are indictments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't know. I mean, at some point I would like to do another book because I think the case calls for one.
Yeah.
Whether or not that will be so, I don't know, or whether I'll just do some more television on it, I just don't know.
Wow. Well, it's an incredible story, Maury, and I want to thank you for you know, being on the program with us, talking about this this article in Gear Magazine. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks, Michael. My pleasure.
All right. We'll stay in touch. I'm sure if anything else develops, we can talk to you again.
Absolutely so.
Okay. Maury, thank you very much. That was
all right. So that was Maury Terry. It's an interview that's on, it's on YouTube. I got it from BitChute, but it is on YouTube, that one. So that's it. I mean, I'm going to keep looking at these things. If he's right, and we know that the sexual blackmail rings are there, we know that people are being coerced into sex with children or whatever to be blackmailed, or prostitutes to be blackmailed, and we know that there's high level abuse going on. So it makes me look at this kind of murder and murders and conspiracy as part of that. To me, it's part of the same beast, really. It's part of the same web of destruction and drug running. I think the drug running angle is an important one, because there's money in drugs and there's money in prostitution. So I think it's worth pursuing that angle. Welcome, Carlotta. I'm just about to wrap up. But I will be posting this one to my podcast, so you'll be able to find it there. If you subscribe to the podcast or follow me, then you'll be able to find the material. But I am wrapping up now. I've done an hour and 10 minutes. So, well, that whole program was an hour and 9 minutes. And my intro and the conclusion is 3 minutes of it. But it's good material, so it's worth sharing. And I think you've got to look at it in the context of Epstein and of the Franklin cover-up and all of these other things. So New York is certainly part of a big web of intrigue, and we need to unravel it. We need to unravel it. All right, that's it for now. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again soon.